Today is a little bit unusual. This is important because what I'm saying on this recording today is not just lab material. This is also lecture material. And I'm going to be showing you three slides from a chapter that I haven't gotten to yet in lecture. So when I get upstairs and we get to these three slides, I'll skip over. I'm not going to go over it twice. I just realize this stuff is for both upstairs and downstairs. Okay? The reason that we're doing this procedure today is to investigate processes of transport of materials into or out of cells. And there are three major categories of such transport processes, three major ways in which things can be transported into or out of cells. Does anyone happen to know these three categories or any of them? Well, osmosis is a specific case of one of the categories. Diffusion is an example of one of the categories. The three categories are active transport. You can probably guess the second. What is it? Passive transport. And the third, which we'll talk more about later in lecture only, but I'll give you the name of it, is vesicular transport. All of these things can get things into or out of cells, but vesicular transport is special because in vesicular transport, a vesicle is used, and I'll explain how it happens in lecture. But the reason it's special is because something goes into the cell or out of the cell without actually going through a membrane. So it's kind of a cheating mechanism, really. In the other two, active and passive transport, the thing that's being transported, whatever kind of particle it is, actually goes through a membrane, either into the cell or out of the cell. And those are the two that I'll talk a little bit more about in here. And specifically, we're mostly going to be talking about passive. But what is the basis for the distinction between active and passive transport? Not necessarily ATP, but it's an energy distinction. And what I don't want you to think, despite what you might even read on websites or whatever, I don't want you to think that passive transport doesn't require energy. That's false. Things don't move for free. Movement of things requires energy, including in passive transport. But for passive transport, there is no requirement of expenditure of additional or outside energy, because the energy is already built into the system, which I'll explain in a minute. All right? Active transport, on the other hand, requires additional energy to be supplied. And it's true that the source of that additional energy is often ATP, but it doesn't have to be. All right? So active transport and vesicular transport we'll revisit in more detail upstairs for lecture only. For the rest of this today's stuff, I want to talk about passive transport. And passive transport is kind of paradoxically a process that is directed, meaning it happens in a specific direction, even though it is caused by random movement of particles. Particles are randomly moving, yet that random movement causes a net movement of particles in one direction or another. Okay, so it's a directed process caused by random movement. And I'll just use an analogy or a thought experiment that you don't actually have to go through with but can imagine doing to help make sense of this. It really just uses people instead of particles to explain why diffusion, which is passive, diffusion is really what passive transport is. Diffusion, when we use the word diffusion by itself, we're really usually referring to net diffusion. Net diffusion means diffusion in one direction more than another. All right? And that's what I will model in this example using humans as particles. This is a two-dimensional example. In reality, things are moving in three dimensions, not just two dimensions. But if you have a large room, like a gymnasium or something, which would be like a container of particles, and you get a bunch of humans to participate, each person is a particle, you first have to prepare the room. So you stop time temporarily. Time is not passing while you set the thing up. If you get the people, which I'll just represent as dots, to congregate in a group in the middle, so they're close together, and you also just randomly position them so that each person is facing some direction randomly. The direction that a person facing, though, is going to determine which direction that person moves in when the time starts. All right, because particles are, each individual particle in a population is moving at its own speed and own direction. By the way, that random movement of particles is called Brownian motion. And that's what diffusion is based on. All right, so you set it up that way. Now notice that what I have created here with this tight group of people and then no people around it till you get to the walls of the container is a comparatively high concentration of particles here and a low concentration over here, right? The reason that this is important is that diffusion, net diffusion, occurs always from high concentration to low concentration, from a place where there's comparatively higher concentration to a place where there is comparatively lower concentration. That's why it's a directed process. It's always in the direction toward lower concentration, despite the fact that everything's moving randomly. Okay, now, what we have here is a highly concentrated group of particles and lower concentration over here. Now, if I start the clock, and these are actual real people doing this, that would mean when I say go, every person starts moving whatever direction he's faced, or she, and move in a straight line in that direction until you hit someone or something, in which case you should bounce in the appropriate direction and start moving in a straight line in that new direction, just like particles do when they hit each other. Okay? If you imagine doing that, then all of these people in the middle aren't going to get very far, right? They're just going to be bouncing off of each other. The only people that have a chance of escaping the group are the people on the periphery, the edge of the group. And even those, some of them, will be facing toward the middle of the group. So they're not going to get anywhere either, right? They're going to just bounce off another person. But for people that are both on the edge and just randomly facing outward, they're going to be able to walk away from the group until they hit a wall and start bouncing. And the more that happens, the more particles or people are removed from the group, the more it exposes more on the edge, some of which will be able to leave. So even though it's random movement causing this, it happens in such a way that it's always going to be net diffusion from higher concentration to lower concentration. Does that make sense? Now, I mentioned earlier that even passive transport requires energy. Well, it's the energy of motion. It's the heat. It's the thermal energy of particles moving that is causing this. But the source, the true source of energy for net diffusion, which I said it was built in earlier, is what we call a gradient. Gradient is a general word that really just means a difference of something, a difference in some measurement at one place compared to another place. So there's all kinds of different gradients, for instance. Voltages, for instance, are gradients. Gradients are differences in charge. One side of the outlet, one electrode in there is different in charge compared to the other. So that's an electrical charge difference. That's what a voltage is. There are pressure gradients, for instance, which is why water comes out of the hose. Water's going from higher pressure to lower pressure. Things go down their gradients naturally, in other words, including in diffusion. But the specific kind of gradient that drives net diffusion is a concentration gradient. And diffusion always happens in a direction from higher concentration to lower concentration. That's down the concentration gradient. That's not to say that things can't be moved against their gradient or up their gradient, which would be from low concentration to high concentration, but that is never going to happen on its own. There's no built-in energy that's going to force that to happen. You have to supply that energy to force it to happen, and that's what active transport is. And that's not what we're talking about today. All right? So, the source of energy that drives net diffusion is the gradient itself. And I'll be repeating this over and over throughout the term, so you might as well learn it now. A gradient is a source of potential energy, meaning that a gradient can do some work for you if it's set up correctly. Now, net diffusion means movement in one direction more than another, like I said earlier. So if you think about these humans, if I leave them at it and I come back 2 hours later, there will no longer be a gradient because they'll all be equally spread out, bouncing off the walls, evenly spaced throughout the entire room, right? So the gradient would be zero, no difference from point A to point B. And this brings up the important point that there are two major requirements for net diffusion to occur. One is that there has to be a gradient in place. When they're all spread out, there's no more gradient. That doesn't mean they stop. They're still moving around, but it's not net diffusion when they're no longer moving in one direction more than another. Okay, so for net diffusion to occur, you have to have a gradient. The second requirement for net diffusion is that there has to be a way for that particle type, whatever it is, to get from place A to place B down the gradient. So the gradient has to be there, but that's not enough. There also has to be a way for the particles to get from where they are more highly concentrated to where they are less highly concentrated. All that clear? Okay. Let's look at these slides. We see in slide 10 of this chapter we haven't gotten to yet, net diffusion in cartoon form. Each of these This box, it looks like there are six boxes, but these three at the top are the same box, just at different times. All right, so you have a compartment, the overall box that is
divided into two subcompartments.
Notice that there's a dashed line in the middle, separating left from right. The dashed line represents a membrane. Now, let me pause here and say that membranes aren't necessarily involved in diffusion, in net diffusion. What we would call just simple diffusion doesn't involve any membrane. A familiar example of this is to just plunk a sugar cube into a glass of water. Right at the beginning, as the cube gets put into the water, there is a high concentration of sugar particles where the cube is, right? A low concentration everywhere else. So a gradient is in place. That's one requirement for net diffusion. The other requirement is there has to be a way for the particles to move from high concentration to low concentration. Well, there's nothing stopping them there, right? They can easily diffuse from the sugar cube outward into the water. There's nothing blocking them. So, net diffusion is going to occur. But when it comes to cells, which is what we're really investigating here, the potato is made of cells, each of which is covered by a membrane, then membranes are involved. In other words, net diffusion can occur without a membrane, but sometimes it can occur through a membrane. Well, the dashed line here represents what is called a selectively permeable membrane. Permeable just by itself means something can permeate through it, meaning pass through it. A selectively permeable membrane means that only certain kinds of particles can permeate or pass through it. Others can't. And that's exactly what the plasma membrane of cells is. It allows certain things through it and other things not. Okay? Well, in this cartoon version, you start off with all of these dye molecules, these orange balls, on the left half, on one side of the membrane. But this selectively permeable membrane happens to be permeable to this particular kind of dye molecule. So you have both conditions met for net diffusion. There is a gradient, right? Because there's a high concentration on the left compartment, a low concentration on the right. The gradient is the tendency for diffusion to occur, because the gradient powers the process. But there also has to be a way to get there. Well, there's nothing blocking them because these particles can get through the holes in the membrane. So, if you give it time, that's what's going to happen. There's random movement, but there's going to be more movement from left to right than there is from right to left, simply because there's more on the left originally to move toward the right. And if you come back later, it will be at equilibrium. At equilibrium, there is no more net diffusion, meaning that there's just as much movement in one direction as there is in the other. So it's not that particles stop when net diffusion ends. It just means there's no more movement in one direction more than the other. There's two different ways that equilibrium can be attained, diffusion-wise. And one of those is shown here. One way is simply to eliminate the gradient. In this case, the gradient is eliminated because there's exactly the same concentration on both sides. So they're going to move right to left and left to right at equal rates. No more net diffusion. I'll show you another way that you can get to equilibrium in a different slide. So that's just one type of particle we focused on in this first row example. The bottom makes an important point. Here we're involving two different particles, orange dye and purple dye. And the important point is that every different kind of particle has its own gradient. that is independent of all other gradients. And therefore, if a particle moves by net diffusion, it does so only because of its own gradient, not at all affected by any other gradients, any other types of particles. So in this case, they both happen to be able to get through the selectively permeable membrane. At first, there are two gradients at play here. There's an orange dye gradient. There's a purple dye gradient. They don't have anything to do with each other, and they're in opposite directions, notice. Right? The orange balls, in a sense, want to go toward the right because that's downhill in gradient-wise for them. The purple ones have the reverse gradient. They want to go to the left. And so they both will. And you come back later, they are both at equilibrium at that point. Net diffusion for both particles has stopped. But purple does not affect, purple's gradient does not affect orange's gradient. All right, that is diffusion through a membrane, which we use the word diffusion for. But now we want to talk about a special case of diffusion. Using slide 11 eventually, but just let me give you some background information. When I say it's a special case, it is still diffusion. All right? But we don't use the word in this special case. We change the name of it. What we're looking at here is osmosis. All osmosis is diffusion, but not all diffusion is osmosis. Okay, so osmosis is a subset or special case of diffusion. And it is a special case for two reasons. In other words, there's two things that have to be true for diffusion to qualify as osmosis. All right? One of those things is that the particles moving in osmosis are solvent particles, not solute particles. Those dye balls that we looked at, those were solutes. We didn't bother paying attention to the water. It was just a blue background. But the water molecules are actually there, of course. They're particles in their own right. But we've talked already about the difference between solvents and solutes, right? Well, if you're talking about osmosis, then the thing moving has to be solvent, not solute. That's one requirement. But that is not enough. Think back to this sugar cube in the water example. You have two different kinds of particles, sugar molecules, water molecules. They each have their own gradient, independent of each other, right? At the very first moment, there's a high concentration of sugar at the cube, low in the water. There's a high concentration of water in the water, a low concentration in the sugar cube. So they're trying to go in opposite directions. And they will, independently. Each one's going down its own gradient. But in that case, even though water is moving and water is solvent, that is not osmosis. Because it doesn't fulfill the second requirement for it to be osmosis. In addition to the particle having to be a solvent, the other requirement for osmosis is that the diffusion has to be through a selectively permeable membrane. And specifically, that means the solvent can get through and other things can't. All right? So that's what we have here. This is truly an example of osmosis, whereas the sugar cube in a glass is not. What we have here is a glass U-tube. That's the original use of the phrase U-tube, a glass in a U-shape. It's compartmentalized as well. Notice on the bottom you have a selectively permeable membrane. And in this case, the membrane is not permeable to the solutes, the green balls. It is permeable to water. And therefore, this is going to be osmosis. But let me say something about the definition of osmosis before I go on with this example. And that's because most books phrase the definition of osmosis in a way that seems confusing, even though it's true. I don't know whether you've read definitions of osmosis in other courses or not, but most books will phrase the definition something like this. First of all, it'll say it's movement of water, which is not always true. Osmosis can be the movement of any solvent, but in biology, the solvent is always water. So biology books will say water. Anyway, that's not the main problem. What's confusing is that most books will say something like, osmosis is movement of water from a place of low solute concentration to a place of high solute concentration. Which is true, but it sounds like it's an exception to diffusion, right? Because diffusion is always high concentration to low concentration. But the confusing definition is basing things on the solutes, not on the water, which is the thing that's moving. So when you say water is moving from low solute concentration to high solute concentration, that's really just a backwards way of saying water is moving from a high water concentration to a low water concentration. You see what I'm trying to say here? If you say something is a low solute concentration, that means it's very watery. If it's a high solute concentration, then it's not very watery. It's a low water concentration. So, yes, it is true the way books phrase it, but just think of osmosis being diffusion of water down its own gradient. It has to be down its gradient for it to be diffusion, but also through a membrane. If it's not through a membrane, even though it's water, then it's not osmosis. Is that all clear? Now back to this YouTube. Before we start the clock, notice that the solution, because these are two solutions on the two sides, the solution on the left half is lower concentration of solutes, right? Concentration of solutes is higher on the right side. But as I just said, what that means really is that the lower solute concentration solution is more watery than the right side, which is higher solute concentration, lower water concentration on the right. And the only thing that matters when it comes to water moving down its gradient is the water gradient. Just like I said before, all particles obey only their own gradients. So, even though the water molecules aren't shown in detail, well, I guess they are down here, close up. The water molecules being more highly concentrated on the left half, a gradient is in place. That's one of the requirements for diffusion, and all osmosis is diffusion, so it has to have the same requirements. That gradient is the tendency for water to move. There's also, independently, a gradient for green particles, except their gradient is favoring them to move from right to left. Independent gradients. But green particles can't get through, so they can't fulfill the second requirement for net diffusion, and they don't diffuse. They don't get through the membrane. Water can fulfill the second requirement because it has a way to get from high concentration to low concentration. It can permeate the membrane. And so it will. If you start the clock, it will happen. And the more that happens, notice you're taking away water molecules from the left compartment and putting them into the right compartment. That's why the water level goes down on the left. You're removing water, but you're not replacing it with anything, and you're putting more water into the right side, which is getting higher. Okay, now, the after picture on the right here looks like it has stopped because of equilibrium due to the elimination of a gradient, which I said was one way that could happen, right? They look like they're pretty much evenly spaced, so they look like equal concentrations to me. And if they are, there's no gradient and therefore no more net osmosis. But even though it's not pictured, I want you to imagine something. Exactly the same situation to start, except that the left half doesn't have any green particles at all. All right. Now there's going to be a gradient for water, just like there was before, in the same direction, and water's going to move from left to right. Correct? But since it's pure water on the left, well, let me say something else first. When water moves from left to right, that is diluting the right side more and more, right? The concentration of solutes is going down because you're adding water. It's becoming more dilute. But if you start with pure water on the left, which is the highest concentration of water you can have, right? You can't be more concentrated than pure water. Doesn't matter how much moves to the right, doesn't matter how dilute you get this right half, as long as there's some solute particles, it's still going to be less watery than pure water. You see my point here? And therefore, no matter how much water moves, you're still going to have a gradient in place. Because the right side is never going to be pure water, since it has solutes in it. And therefore, the gradient would not be eliminated in that case. So there is a continued tendency, if it's pure water to start with on the left, for osmosis to continue. It still, though, comes to equilibrium, even though the gradient wouldn't be eliminated. And this is the other reason that I was talking about why it could come to equilibrium. Notice that when you add more and more water to the right, the level of the overall volume gets higher on the right side. Well, that higher that level gets, the more it's being pulled down by gravity. So you have two exactly opposing forces. Osmotic force, which is trying to push water into the right side and therefore increase the water level. And gravity, which is trying to push water downward and then back to the left. And when those two forces get to the point where they exactly equal each other, then it will be in equilibrium, even though there's still an osmotic gradient in place. And at equilibrium, no matter whether it's because of elimination of a gradient or because of opposing forces equaling each other, equilibrium will mean there is no more net osmosis. Things are still moving. It's just that just as many water molecules will be going left to right as are going right to left, and therefore the volumes don't change. Does all that make sense? Any questions at all? Okay. Then we'll go to 12, and I need to give you some definitions. Oh, I thought it was bright up there. I'm surprised no one bitched. Now we need to talk about tonicity. Tonicity, in general, refers to the tendency for osmosis to occur into or out of a cell. And I need to warn you that there might be errors in the manual, because the author of this doesn't get this, the use of these terms right. This is the new version. It might have been fixed, but maybe not. So I'm going to tell you the right way to use these terms. Don't follow examples in the manual if they differ from what I say. All right? There are different degrees of tonicity, which are shown as the headers of these columns. Hypotonic or hypotonicity, isotonic, and hypertonic. Now these are words, these are adjectives, the words that end in tonic are adjectives that describe only the surroundings, the environment outside a cell. And this is what the manual might get wrong, so be careful. Do not use these words, any of these three words, these tonic words, to describe the cell itself. These words always describe the extracellular fluid, the stuff around the cell. Now there's more confusion here with terminology, so I want to describe this. What does hypo mean just as a root?
Hypo.
Yes, it means below. Hypodermic, for instance, below the skin. Hypo means low, iso means same, hyper means above. That's not the confusing part. What's confusing here is that these terms refer to the tendency for osmosis to occur, and the thing that's moving in osmosis, as I just told you, is water, not solutes, right? Despite that, these prefixes, hyper, iso, and hypo, hyper, refer not to the water molecules, but to the solute particles, even though they're not moving or they're not permeating the membrane. That's what's confusing about this. So it's once again, seems backwards, just like the definition of osmosis in most textbooks. So let me say why it does make sense, though. Just keep in mind that the hypo or the hyper or the iso refer to the solutes, and then make sense of it in your mind what that means as far as wateriness concern is. Because it's only the wateriness that matters. It's only the water gradient that matters in osmosis. And also another thing about these terms is that they are always relative. They're not absolute terms. An absolute term is something that would apply in all cases. A relative term means it only makes sense when you compare it to something. So a solution is called hypertonic only in relation to a cell that you're comparing it to. And similarly for the other terms. But what qualifies a solution as being hypotonic, the left one, hypo meaning below, is that that solution has a lower solute concentration than the cell does. Remember that the contents of the cell is its own solution. We call that the cytosol, the solution inside a cell. The liquid part of the cytoplasm, in other words, is the cytosol. So you have two solutions whenever you have a cell surrounded by another solution, right? One solution is inside the cell, and then the environment is the other solution. But as I said, you use these words to refer only to the environment. Well, it's hypotonic if, compared to the cell solution, that environment has a lower solute concentration than the cell. But notice that that just is a backwards way of saying that a hypotonic solution is more watery than the cell. Lower solute concentration means higher water concentration. Does that make sense? And you can't have something that is more watery than pure water. So pure water is as hypotonic as you can possibly get. All right. Well, always keep in mind that if there is a concentration gradient with respect to water, and there's a membrane involved that water can get through, osmosis will occur. But osmosis, if it does occur, always occurs down the water gradient. Osmosis always occurs from more watery place to less watery place, down its own gradient. And that's exactly what happens in the hypotonic solution case. In this case, it's more watery outside because it has a lower concentration of solutes compared to the cell. So water's going to move from where it's more watery, which is out of the cell, to where it's less watery, which is into the cell. On the top row, we have an animal cell, using a red blood cell as a typical example of an animal cell. Animal cells, as we'll talk more about upstairs, have a plasma membrane like any cell does. Any cell has to have a plasma membrane. But that's the only boundary. There isn't also a cell wall. Plant cells have their own plasma membrane, but they have a much thicker and sturdier cell wall outside of that. Animal cells don't have that. So the plasma membrane of an animal cell is pretty flimsy. Or any plasma membrane is flimsy, but that's the only thing the animal cell has. So if you put that animal cell in a hypotonic environment, which is more watery, water is going to come in by osmosis, and that's going to make the cell swell up. And if the gradient is steep enough, or if the cell is in there long enough, so much water will come in that the plasma membrane, flimsy as it is, will not be able to hold the pressure, and it will burst, as you see happening there. That is called lysis. That's the process. Remember, I already said lysis, as in hydrolysis, means splitting. Here you're rupturing the membrane. So this one has lysed. It's undergone lysis. And I shouldn't have to tell you that's bad for the cell. It kills the cell. So what that means is animal cells do not do well in a hypotonic environment. Let's go to the other extreme before we go to the middle. Hypertonic is called hyper, meaning above, because a hypertonic environment has a higher solute concentration than the cell does. But that's just a backwards way of saying that the environment is less watery than the cell. But once again, water is going to move from more watery to less watery. It's just in the opposite direction this time. It's more watery in the cell, less watery outside, so water is going to leave. And of course, that's going to cause shriveling of the animal cell. That shriveling, by the way, is called crenation. With an N, not an M. Oops. Crenation is also bad for the cell. If it's severe enough, it will die from crenation. So animal cells don't do well in either extreme. Iso means the same. So an isotonic solution has the same overall solute concentration than the cell does. But careful with that. That does not at all, nowhere in that definition does it say that the solutes are the same in both solutions, inside and outside the cell. It doesn't matter what kind of solutes they are. You know, if you have a 1 molar glucose solution outside the cell and a 1 molar fructose solution inside the cell, totally different solutes, right? But it's not the solutes that matter, it's the wateriness. And if the overall solute concentration inside and outside is equal, that's just a backwards way of saying they're equally watery. And therefore there is no water gradient, and therefore no tendency for water to move in one direction more than the other. There's going to be no osmosis. No net osmosis. Water is going to be moving, but it's going to be moving both in and out of the cell at equal rates. And that is the healthiest condition for an animal cell, because it neither lyses nor crenates. It remains nice and satisfied and living its life. Okay. You're not dealing with animal cells in your experiment today. You're dealing with plant cells. So let's look at the bottom row. As I said, any cell has a plasma membrane, including a plant cell, including potatoes. But it's a very thin, very much thinner than the cell wall that is outside of the plasma membrane. So in this room, if you consider this room to be a cell, the cell wall, a plant cell that is, the cell wall is like the structure of the wall, the hardness of it. And the paint on the interior surface is like the flimsy plasma membrane inside that cell wall. All right? You put a plant in a hypotonic solution, there's still the same tendency as if it were an animal cell. Hypotonic means more watery than the cell, and therefore water is going to want to osmose into the cell. It does, and it swells it, but eventually the sturdiness of the cell wall, which is not going to burst, is going to fight back with the same amount of force as water is trying to come in with. And it'll come to equilibrium because of that. But it'll come to equilibrium in a state in which the plant cell is nice and swollen or turgid. That's actually the ideal state for a plant cell. This is showing one cell, but a full plant is trillions and trillions of cells, even a tiny plant. If you consider a seedling, the reason that it stands up is because you've given it water. Providing it water means you are making its environment hypotonic. So the water wants to come into the cells. It does. Each individual cell swells, but that means they're now pushing on each other. The millions of cells in the body of the plant are now pushing on each other. And that causes an erection. Very similar to an erection in a penis, except instead of it being blood pressure causing that, it's osmosis. And the plant will stand up. And if you forget to water it, you're no longer maintaining a hypotonic environment, and therefore it's going to no longer be pushing cells on cells because they're not as swollen, and it's going to be limp. Okay, so the ideal situation, unlike animals, for plants is hypotonic. If you put a plant cell into a hypertonic environment, which is less watery than the plant, it's going to lose water, just like an animal cell will. Well, the cell wall is sturdy, so it's not going to collapse. But the water is actually inside, the water that leaves is actually inside the plasma membrane. So when it leaves, it peels that plasma membrane away from the wall, like paint peeling from the wall. And that will kill the plant cell. That is called plasmolysis. This is the verb form, but the process is called plasmolysis, which I'm writing out to warn you that it's confusing also, because it has lysis in the word. But plasmolysis is actually the opposite of lysis. Lysis is rupture of an animal cell in a hypotonic environment. Plasmolysis is shriveling of a plant cell in a hypertonic environment. If you put a plant cell in an isotonic solution, it will survive, but it's not ideal. This is when you have forgotten to water it. It starts getting limp. If you water it soon enough, it won't die. But the cells are flaccid. They're not swollen, and that's not the ideal situation for a plant. Okay. Any questions on any of that? Then let me talk a little bit about the report. Just as last time, you just need to follow the specific instructions for the lab report that's on the page in the manual. But and most of that is pretty straightforward, so I'm not going to talk about all of that, most of that. But I do want to talk about the part that people struggle with. Where in the hell is my... And the part that most people struggle with is one of the questions when it comes to grafting. One of the questions that asks about determining the solute concentration of the potatoes. But even more general than that, I have something to say about grafting. As before, you can use a computer, you can do it by hand as long as you put it into the Word document. But I can almost guarantee that some of you are going to make this mistake, even though I'm telling you specifically not to do this. What are your three... Well, what's your independent variable today? The concentration of the solutions, yes. And what are the three levels?
0.3 molar of distilled water and 0.5 molar.
In other words, 0 molar, that's the distilled water, 0.3 molar and 0.5, is it? Okay. When you graph that, which axis does the independent variable go on? On the bottom, on the x-axis, right. Well, I get some of these every term. 0, 0.3, 0.5. What's wrong with that? No, 0 doesn't have to be all the way to the left. It often is, but it doesn't have to be. What's the problem with it? Well, yeah, but even before we get to that, there's a problem. Zero to 0.3 is not the same distance on the number line as 0.3 to 0.5 is. So don't do that. Now, if this were red, yellow, and green, those are categories, not numbers. So yeah, you could space those out evenly. But these are numbers. So they need to be just like on a number line. There's more distance between 0 and 0.3 than there is between 0.3 and 0.5. And that really matters because it's going to affect your line of best fit. Okay? That's one thing. Now, just assuming you have the axes correctly drawn, I'm not going to actually do them, you'll get three data. Data, by the way, is a plural. So you say data are, not data is. But anyway, your raw data are your actual mass measurements. But you're not, importantly, you're not graphing your individual measurements. So don't give me mass versus concentration. Instead, you need to calculate the change in mass. Right? There's two masses for each of your dishes, before and after. But you don't graph those, you graph the difference between them. In science, we use delta notation to mean change. So the change in mass is defined as mass final minus mass initial. Not the other way around. It's final minus initial. Here's why. If the final mass is greater than the initial mass, what does that mean? Yes, it means an increase in mass. Well, since you define the delta this way, final minus initial, that means big minus small is going to be a positive number. A positive delta is always going to be a gain if you define it this way. But if you did it the other way around, it would be a negative number, right? Well, if the final value is smaller, that means you've lost water. And that would be reflected as a negative value. Everyone good on that? Okay, here's another problem. People think that they have to have zero at the left edge or on the bottom of the y-axis. Well, that's appropriate sometimes when you're only dealing with positive numbers. But you're plotting change in mass, not mass, versus concentration, properly labeled though. And if you lose water, that's going to be a negative change in mass. So zero should not be down here. Zero is going to be somewhere in the middle so that you can have negative values and positive values. All right? Now, I don't know what your data are going to look like, but I'm just going to draw three dots. They're not perfectly linear, as you would expect for real values, because they have error associated with them, especially if you didn't dry them completely consistently before weighing them. But it looks like there's a linear trend here, so we're justified in drawing a line of best fit, which doesn't necessarily go through any of them, right? Just as before. And just as I talked about in general in an earlier lab, you can, when you have a line of best fit, you can use interpolation. Now to this problematic question that very few people understand the way it's written. It's asking you in one of those questions to determine what the solute concentration of the potatoes is. Well, you definitely don't measure that, right? You don't do any measuring of concentrations, whether it's water or solutes. All you're measuring is change in mass. But the membranes of these potato cells are not permeable to the solutes. Therefore, if there is a change in mass, it's due only to water, either entering or leaving. Osmosis is occurring, in other words. All right? How can you use change in mass to determine what the solute concentration is if you're not measuring any concentrations? The only concentrations you know are the concentrations of the solutions you used, right? 0, 0.3, and 0.5. Well, what did I say the definition of isotonic is? Same overall solute concentration in the environment as there is in the potato. That's the key. It's asking you to figure out the concentration of solutes in the potato. And the only way you can know that is if you have an isotonic solution. If you know the concentration of an isotonic solution, by definition of isotonicity, you also know the concentration in the cells. You following me on that? Okay, what would have to happen if a solution is isotonic?
The mass wouldn't change.
The mass would not change, exactly. Now, that's not necessarily going to happen for any of your actual adjusted values, 0, 0.3, and 0.5. But that's why you draw a line of best fit. Okay? Zero change in mass means zero y value on the graph. So all you need to do once you have your line of best fit is go over from zero to the line of best fit and then straight down to the x-axis and read that concentration, and that's what the concentration of the solute must be inside the potato. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been isotonic. Does that make sense? Okay, I'm telling you, in other words, exactly how to do this. And if you're like any other class, many of you still won't do it that way. So obey me, and you'll get higher score value. By the way, all you need to do today, as soon as I shut up, is get your final values and clean up. I recommend not even starting the write-up until you have a grade for the first report, which will likely be Saturday morning or earlier, unless something comes up. But just put it in the back burner. Get your raw data here today. Make sure you record it so you can think about it later. But when it comes time to writing it up, this is how you use your graph. All right, now the other thing, damn it, there is definitely one other thing I wanted to say. Oh, well, this is not what I wanted to say, but I still need to say this. It's another thing that confuses people. As part of today, you also need to look at these dishes. And what confuses people is they come over here and see two dishes with strawberries in it. That is the truth. These are two dishes. But they represent one dish before and after. So think of it that way, okay? And similarly, there's one dish of raisins before and after. So look at the write-up in the manual about that and make sense of it that way. The thing I was forgetting before is that before you leave, you also need to make a drawing on whiteboards, which is why you have a whiteboard out. One drawing per group, and call me around to make sure it's okay before you leave. That's important not only in understanding it and talking it out, but it also can earn you three additional bonus points if you include a snapshot of that drawing in your Word document. I think the manual says to redraw it. You can just insert your photo today once I approve it. So everyone take a picture. That's an example of something you can share, but obviously you can't share the writing or the graph. You have to do those on your own. Okay.